Okay. I like this new mic just fine, except it's got the tiniest little clip on it to catch into anything. We are in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. And what I've done is handed out to you a outline, the first page of which is the kind of overall outline of the Gospel of Matthew. And it's an attempt to show this alternating sections between the story sections and the speech sections, or in the outline they're called narrative sections and discourse sections, because the discourses range from sermons to collections of sayings to speeches of various kinds. But basically Jesus is doing some kind of teaching, and that's what our class is focused on in this section of our overview of the Bible, looking at some of the parables and the teaching of Jesus. And I've chosen to concentrate primarily on the discourses in Matthew and then in the Gospel of John. And I was going to double check with Adam how far he got last week in the Sermon on the Mount, but I didn't talk to him this week, and he's obviously not here this morning. So how far did y'all get last week? I expect you to remember. Yes, I do. Oh, so I'll start all over at the beginning if no one can remember.
Yeah.
Okay. Did we get it through chapter 6?
I believe so. I mean, he kind of sped through chapter 6.
Okay.
But we did get through it. He hit that right towards the.
Okay. Well, good. I had asked him to try to get through chapter 6. And, of course, one of the primary things about chapter 6 is it is one of those sections that deals with Jesus' teaching about materialism. Jesus taught more about money than any other one single thing in all of his teaching as you collect it together. But it's not so much about money as what I've also done is give a more detailed outline. And on what's listed as page 15, which will be on the second sheet here, that's where the bulk of the outline for the Sermon on the Mount is found of what I've given to you. And with the exception of the Beatitudes and so on at the very beginning, as you can see there, the bulk of chapter 5 I've characterized as true righteousness, picking up on that statement that Jesus makes there in chapter 5 and verse 20, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. That is, the kingdom of heaven is for people who are truly righteous. Well, what does that mean? And when you hold up the Pharisees as an example, a standard of righteousness, but then you have to surpass it, that would sound to most ordinary people as astounding. How in the world am I going to be more righteous than the Pharisees are? And yet, what Jesus exposes is that their righteousness is rooted in a kind of idea that it's their own inherent goodness as they keep God's law that somehow earns God's attention and favor to them. And Jesus kind of takes exception to how they have been interpreting God's law and misusing it, misapplying it, and illustrating what the real focus and understanding is. It isn't on doing a bunch of good deeds, and the same, of course, is true today. It's a message just as relevant to us. The focus is on God. We want to be like God. We want to know God.
Well, one of the things that I take from the quote-unquote righteousness of the Pharisees was that they followed the technicalities of the law, but when you take it a step farther, the motivation, the heart, and the things weren't there, and I think that's really where we need to be, is not that, oh, we're dutifully following what's in the law, but is our heart the motivating factor for why we're doing those things that are in the law, because we see that, you know, they were saying prayers out loud to be seen of men. They were giving alms with trumpets to be seen of men. They were doing all the technical things, saying, "Hey, look at how great we are." So it wasn't that the things they were doing technically were incorrect. It was the motivation and the heart that was behind it.
Right. And I think that's very important, because it seems to me the religious world has devolved into two basic points of view, two basic groups of people. There's the group, on the one hand, that sees that their relationship with God hinges upon the doing of good deeds Have they done enough good things that God will overlook what bad they do? And I think the vast majority of people, to some extent, fall in that category. You know, you talk to a lot of people, they're not religious, they don't go to church, but they're comfortable enough. They think, yeah, I do some bad things, I'm not a perfect person, but, you know, I'm a good person. And because of that, God's just going to overlook whatever bad there may be in my life. I've done enough good to outweigh the bad. Now, as far as religious schools of thought, you know, certain denominations and so on, I think you're going to find a much smaller pool of people who actually officially teach and say, yes, your salvation solely depends upon keeping all of these rules and regulations. The majority of official teaching that we hear in the religious world is the other group, which is because of God's grace, and God is so loving and so merciful that really you don't have anything to worry about, and sin is really not that significant. Don't worry about it. Don't lose any sleep over it. And the Sermon on the Mount would criticize both of these schools of thought. And so the Pharisees, I do think, tend to represent this mentality of keeping God's law, and it's being some kind of badge of honor, something to parade in front of other people. Look at all the good deeds that we're doing. And as Shane said, there's no heart in it. There's no real faith. And that's where we were saying our focus is on God and a relationship with God. But at the same time, if that's true, then that means this kind of taking God for granted attitude and really not caring about what he said. You know, don't do these things. They displease me. They grieve me because I know they hurt you and you insist on doing them. And I tell you, don't do that. Well, I don't care what God says. I'm going to do what I want. And God tells us these things we do need to do. Well, what does God know? You know, and this kind of flippant, irreverent attitude about God, well, that's equally condemned. And so it does take us back to the true heart of faith and trust in God and a relationship with Him. And in that way, our righteousness will surpass that of the Pharisees. Of course, Jesus isn't saying, you know, don't obey God and don't do the things that God's told you to do. We do need to be doing those things, as meticulous as the Pharisees were, but do so with conviction and with a heart of trust in God, knowing that it's not the doing of the things themselves that make us righteous with God, but rather that we trust in Him and He will count our faith, our trust in Him as righteousness, just as He did Abraham. And it's with that trust in God's grace and also our determination to please Him that we can put our head down and rest more peacefully at night. And I do think when we get to chapter 6 that, as I've characterized it in the outline here, the spiritual motivation of the disciple. And you notice the first 18 verses or so deal with these external actions of almsgiving or praying or fasting, things you can do to be seen of other people. And that's the motivation basically the Pharisees had in doing those things. And Jesus says, of course, our motive needs to be a more internal one, that we can do these things even if no one sees, no one's around to see. And that's why I've often said the truest measure of what kind of Christian we are is, you know, what will we do when no one else is around? What kind of person are we when we're just praying? No one else is around to impress with our praying words. No one else is there to see us. No one else can peer into our mind. It's just me and God. Who am I there in that moment? And that's who I really am. Unless I've gotten so self-deceived, I think I can pull one over on God, you know. God, I thank you. I'm not like that. Anyway. And then the latter part of the chapter deals with the motivation, of course, of material things versus the spiritual. That's one of those things that trips us up a lot of times. And, of course, it isn't the money itself. I don't know too many people that just want money. You know, they want money because it buys comfort, because it buys security, because it buys, you know, freedom from various fears. But that's what gets to the heart of what's the problem with money. We put our trust in what money can do for us and not in God, and that it necessarily undercuts any spirituality, therefore. Anything that takes away from our trust in God and puts it somewhere else, it weakens us as God's people. Doesn't mean Christians can't have money. It's just you can't put your trust in it. And that's what Paul says to Timothy at the end of 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. Teach those that are wealthy about how to not put their confidence in the uncertainty of riches, but to do good with the blessings that God has given to them. And money does become probably the most tangible expression of this world and all that it represents. But you could easily substitute in this material perspective in Matthew chapter 6. You know, some people may not want money, but they want fame or they want power. You know, a lot of politicians are willing to be paid a whole lot less than they might make in private business, but they like the attention and the power that they might have. So there's a variety of material things. Maybe it's our beauty. Maybe it's our great intellectual capacity, our athletic ability. You know, all these things that we put great store in, and those things will take us away from God to the degree we put our trust in those things. And that's kind of that background that brings us into chapter 7, which gives the appearance of being a series of proverbial statements, of kind of short little sayings on a variety of topics, I guess you might say. But it seems to me that what Jesus is doing here, he's really continuing a lot of the same themes of the Sermon on the Mount and summarizing some of that to a certain extent, and basically boiling it down to a choice between two ways of doing things. And that's why you'll notice I've outlined here, I've called the whole section the wisdom of the disciple, which is kind of a cheater's way of just balling all that together. But, you know, I've contrasted all of these things, hypocrisy versus humility and so forth. But even you'll notice back up into chapter 6, there's a lot of contrast that has already been introduced in the Sermon on the Mount. You know, your righteousness versus that of the Pharisees, serving money versus serving God, you know, those types of things. And so again, I think the Sermon on the Mount is coherent. There's a point to what Jesus is doing and the application he's making here. I'm reminded, you know, one preacher that my brother heard and related this story to me. He said, this preacher said, I don't know why preachers get criticized all the time for rambling in their sermons. Jesus did it in the Sermon on the Mount. So, you know, it's good for him. It's good enough for me. Well, I think maybe you ought to go back and read the Sermon on the Mount and reconsider whether Jesus is rambling or not, and see if, in fact, there is a theme that runs through the entire sermon. And as we emphasized at the beginning, that theme really is who can be a true disciple of the kingdom, who is fit for the kingdom, who has what it takes to be under the rule of God. And Jesus started out with the Beatitudes of saying it's got to be somebody who's absolutely humble, who's ready to surrender their life over to God and put their trust in Him. And that's really all that Jesus has been exploring from that point on. What does it mean to put your trust in God to that degree, you know, that low that you're willing to put yourself and turn your life over to Him? Well, let's look at some of these particular sections in chapter 7. And I'll just go ahead and take it section by section as I've outlined it here, whether that's good or bad. But chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, of course, is one of the most well-known texts, at least verse 1. Do not judge, lest you be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that's in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Well, we've heard this used, of course, and applied in every kind of situation. Don't ever judge anybody. You know, you shouldn't judge anyone. That's bad. And of course, as soon as someone tells you that, you shouldn't be judging me, well, they're judging you for judging them, you know, and they're violating the very principle they're supposedly applying here. So what is Jesus talking about? Don't judge.
See?
Well, what is Jesus talking about here in the first five verses, really? What does he mean about not judging? Okay, we'll start with Joe here in a minute.
In my opinion, I think Jesus is offering some insight as to how God treats us. A person that goes around pointing the finger and judging others and condemning others and real strictly condemning others and real, stringent, angry judgment of others, well, God is going to judge that person in that way. But a person who is kind and forgiving and not so strict, not so judgmental of others, God will be more merciful and gentle with that person.
Okay, all right.
Okay. Well, there's two trains of thought. I mean, either he's talking about condemnation, exercising, well, you're condemned to damnation because of what you're doing, or like Joe's saying, it's just that judgmental jumping to conclusions, not finding out what the facts are before you pass judgment on that person. Well, I saw that person over in this neighborhood, and there's
right.
They were outside a bar over there, so I know
right.
They must have been in there.
Right.
They must have been drinking. So,
right.
Right. That type of thing.
Right. Right. Laurel?
That's basically what I was going to say. I understood it to be is don't assign a motive to what somebody has done when you have no idea why they've done a certain,
okay.
behavior or reacted a certain way. Always give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay. All right. Harold?
I think about the real answer. It's what Jesus says in verse 12, where he made quite a summary of the entire law and prophets in a statement that we call the golden rule. And if we keep that golden rule in mind of the way that we want to be treated, and even the way God has treated us, and the way we must treat God, it works both ways.
Right.
You're really getting an idea of what the law and the prophets were all about. There were judgments that had to be made.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it.
Right.
And there was accountability.
Right.
There's no question about that.
Okay.
And yet all of this had to be done from a view of God's standpoint and the way he thinks and the way that we must think. But we're missing the point.
Okay. All right. Lawson?
John 7:24, judge righteously. And the first verse is not saying not to judge, but to judge fairly.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we find other passages that say to judge righteously. Not according to just the appearance of things, but in fact or in substance. You obviously have to harmonize it with what the Bible reveals elsewhere.
Well, I think the bottom line for all of us, if our motivation is right, and this is one of the things that I talk to the kids about, and sometimes I mention in prayer, when I'm leading a public prayer with the family and such, but our goal here as a group of God's people is for all of us to get to heaven. I mean, my motivation should not be, I saw Harold doing something. I'm going to go take Harold to task, and I'm going to show Harold up because I know the scripture better than Harold, and I'm going to show him where he's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If I even remotely think that Harold's involved in something that's questionable, then I go to him in love and Harold, can I ask you about this? I mean, what's going on here? And when Harold explains it, it's something that, my mind went a totally different direction than what Harold was actually doing or his motivation. Or it could be that he's involved in something. He said, I appreciate you pointing that out to me. And through love and care for one another, we help one another back into the fold and come back in, to follow what's right. Not that we use this to punish. Oh, I've got thou shalt not, and I'm gonna hammer you over the head with it.
Right,
It's that type of motive. We're here to help one another, and not to punish.
Well, I think those are some good points. Do you want to rebuttal or these accusations of you, Harold?
What are you saying is absolutely.
Yeah. And I think we ought to explore that a little bit more, too, because if that's our true motivation, because we love Harold and we want to help Harold get to heaven, you want to get to heaven, and you're not doing this to make yourself feel better and superior and all that, Well, obviously, it's not just a matter of when he may do something wrong or just even something we may think's important enough to ask a question about. What about 95% of the time where we want to be saying things to him that are positive and encouraging and nurturing? There's no problem that we see. We just, you know, how would people act toward one another that love one another and trying to help one another get to heaven? And that exposes the, you know, what is our motive when the only time Harold hears from me is when I think he's done something wrong and I'm getting on to him? What does that tell him? I don't really care about him. I don't really care about having a relationship with him. I just, for some reason, want to get on his case, you know. But if I'm really concerned about him, why are all the other times I'm, you know, saying something to him, but something that's more positive?
We only if we simply look at just how the Pharisees treated them that they ruled over, and you can imagine how many people lose heart on their relationship with God due to the judgment that the Pharisees place on them, but wouldn't place on themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and here, just what Shane put it, is that, you know, our goal here is to bring people to Christ and bring us, you know, bring our family especially to Christ. You know, and all we're doing with the intention of, you know, setting them apart and saying, you know, you can't have a part of God's family because you're doing this and so, and without the love and care that needs to be with it, then we've defeated the whole purpose.
Right. And hypocrisy is one of the things that Jesus mentions in here explicitly. You know, how can you say, well, let me help you with a speck in your eye and you've got a log in your own eye and that type of thing. And, of course, I've commented on this passage before that I think some people go away assuming, well, if there was a case in which, you know, Shane is the one with the log in his eye and I just have a speck, it wouldn't be hypocritical for me to help him with his log, you know. But I think Jesus is making a little bit different point, which is, you know, my own sin is always a huge problem to me. You know, and as much as I should be concerned about Shane's sin and help him as much as I can, you know, in the final analysis, it's in Shane's court whether he's going to do the right thing and make the right choices. I can't decide that for him. But me, I chose to sin, and that's my sin, and it's always going to be a huge log in my eye compared to the speck that's in. That should be my attitude, you know, about that. And that then determines the way in which I approach him. You know, if I go to Shane remembering I'm a sinner and I have my own struggles, now maybe I don't struggle with alcoholism, you know. Let's assume that's we're really helping one another this morning, aren't we? You know, because I don't struggle with that particular sin, and I look down my nose at him, well, because he's struggling with some silly thing over here. But he could easily say, well, Tom, what about your sin? Well, but of course, everybody knows that's a hard sin. Well, you know, people have different temptations, and what we might think something silly that somebody's struggling with, they, for them, is very powerful and overwhelming. And I just need to remember I've got my own temptations that are powerful and overwhelming to me, and that's what causes us to be sympathetic and not categorize things and say, well, the things that Tom Hamilton has trouble with, those are the important things, you know, that we have to be merciful and patient with people over. The silly things Tom doesn't have trouble with, well, those things, you people are just a bunch of reprobates if you got trouble with that. And that would be another hypocritical kind of approach to that. Shane?
Well, to add to that, I mean, the other reason why it's my own sin is always the law or the beam that's in my eye is because this is what's going to keep me out of heaven.
Right.
You know, the speck that's in your eye isn't going to keep me out of heaven.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with whether I make it there or not.
Right.
I mean, it's you know, my sin won't keep you out of heaven, but it'll keep me out of heaven.
Right.
So that's
right.
That's really why another reason why it's the, you know, it's,
right.
It's a bigger factor for ourselves.
Right.
To make sure that we're right.
Yeah. And on the surface of it, you know, maybe I killed somebody and you just told a little white lie, but you know, I could still repent of what I've done and make it right with the Lord, but if you won't make it right, then that will keep you out of heaven, like you're saying. And then one other final thing I would say about this is it does seem to me that Jesus is making a general comparison here in the sense that if you think about it, it really boils down that there's two ways of judging people. You can give people what they deserve or you can be merciful to them. And I think ultimately that's what Jesus is getting at here. If we insist on everybody getting what they deserve, then where does that put me when I stand before God on the day of judgment and I get what I deserve? And so if I realize I want God to be merciful to me, then how can I turn around and insist that I won't be merciful to others, or God shouldn't be merciful to them? So we can't have two standards, one for me and one for everybody else. If it's going to be everybody gets what they deserve, then that's where I'm going to fall. If it's mercy, then I can stand before God on the basis of mercy. And that's just a reminder of all those times, you know, we've already seen it in the Sermon on the Mount, even back in connection with the so-called Lord's Prayer and the teaching of the Lord. You know, if you don't forgive others, God's not going to forgive you. If you insist on a system in which there's no forgiveness, you won't find any forgiveness because you've chosen the other system. So you have a choice of two ways here, a way of mercy or a way of everybody getting what they deserve. And we need to choose, of course, a way of mercy. Now, verse 6, do not give what's holy to dogs. Do not throw your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. Well, that's just one of those verses that seems to stick out. Why is that here? Could you have just as easily put that in chapter 5 or chapter 6 or left it out altogether? You know, is there anything that this verse has in common with the five verses prior to this? And I guess you could say humility is a theme that ties it together. Here's a person who goes around judging others and imposing, you know, speaking for God and presuming to pass judgment and all that kind of thing. Here's another type of person who really is doing the same thing by going and shoving the gospel down people's throats instead of, if someone doesn't want to hear the gospel, move on. You know, we're not here to coerce anyone into changing their life and being what we make them to be. We present the gospel to them as an opportunity to choose whether they want to have their life right with the Lord or not. That seems to me what I think of when I read that passage. Any of you have any thoughts on that? You ever been in a situation where you felt you were doing that? Joe?
I find myself in that situation all the time where I'm trying to preach righteousness and goodness and the gospel of Jesus Christ to somebody, and not only do they not want to hear it, they become antagonistic and I get an earful of unpleasantness, and I won't name anybody any names or anything like that, but I have ongoing relationships that are like that. And this verse really speaks to me because I'm one of those evangelistic type Christians. I want everybody to believe what I believe, and I want everybody to be saved, and I don't know.
Right, but you know, and like you say, we get to that point where we just have to accept. Some people aren't going to accept the truth, and I think of that wife in 1 Peter chapter 3 who doesn't have a believing husband, and I don't think that passage means she never makes an attempt to speak to her husband about the gospel, but if doing that, he is belligerent about it and so on, it gets to a point where there's no point continuing to harp on that and, you know, nag someone about the gospel. So I think that's what that passage envisions as well. But there's always hope for people, of course. You know, the passage isn't saying let's pass judgment on people and determine who's a dog, who's a pig, and we're not going to share the gospel with them. But in terms of focus, if there are others that we can spend our time sharing the gospel with that haven't had the chance yet or seem they may still be open-minded toward it, then by what rationale do we keep trying to just nag someone else with the gospel? And our lives also will speak loudly to those people anyway, again, like in 1 Peter chapter 3. All right, well, let's move on. Here's another familiar section. Ask and it'll be given to you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it'll be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds. To him who knocks it'll be opened. What man is there among you when his son shall ask for a loaf, that he will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? And therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them, for this is the law and the prophets. Well, what's Jesus saying here? Anything you ask God for, he's going to pony it up and give it to you? Well, human experience doesn't tell us that, so either we're not really praying, or you're not praying in faith enough or something, or maybe that's not really what Jesus is saying. You know, sometimes we make absolute statements out of things that aren't really absolute, or we assume a definition of terms that really are not intended. I think Jesus' main point here is you need to pray, and you need to have trust in God and to pray. And the principle is, if you pray in faith to God, God will answer. And since we know that the ultimate prayer of a Christian is always, God, you do what's best, you know, no one can come to God in an arrogant attitude with a list of things he's demanding from God and saying, it's going to be this and this and this and anything less, I, you know, curse your name, God. And it doesn't work that way. You know, it's in humility, you come before your Father and you say, Father, if this is according to your will and this is what is best, you know, this is what I would like. And if not, you know, I don't really want it if that's not what's best. Nathan?
What he goes on to say further clarifies that it's not just you ask for anything and he'll give you anything. I mean, which father, if his son said, I'm hungry, I want a stone, would give him that instead of a loaf of
right.
bread? Or said, I want a poisoned snake, would give him that instead of
right.
you know, fish? And the point is, God will give you the good things that you need. And if he knows better than us what's good for us and what isn't, then who are we to say otherwise?
Okay. Lawson?
Does the Greek here infer keep asking? I mean, persistence?
It could. I mean, it is a present tense. That's a judgment from the context. I mean, grammar alone wouldn't establish that, but it certainly is it seems a perspective of persistence. You know, the Bible teaches us that in many places, to be persistent in prayer. Although here I would think the real focus is more on who do you think God is? You know, how you pray is ultimately determined by who you think God is. What is your attitude about God? And so do you think of a God as your Father? Do you think he is a good God who will respond in love to your requests? If you do, you will ask. You will act as people who trust in him. If you're trusting in yourself, you think it's all on your own shoulders to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and all that, there will be no asking. So it really, again, keeps our focus on that concept of humility, and God is a generous God, and he acts in love toward us, will do what's best for us, and so on. And I think that's what the logical connection is now with verse 12, because you notice verse 12 starts with therefore, you know, because God gives us, you know, generously what we've asked for in love. He's not giving us snakes and rocks. However you want people to treat you, you treat them. You know, I think clearly he's saying that, you know, this is what God's character is, and that needs to be your own character now. And so what it shows again is prayer is not like the Pharisees certainly prayed all the time. But to them, prayer was, again, a self-exalting, kind of sell yourself to God, make your case to God of what kind of great person you are, deserving of the things that you demand from him. But no, if you understand who God is and you want to be like God, then, again, your life that you live in service to others is going to be consistent with that life of faith in prayer because of who you are. You are genuinely who you are. And so who you are in your closet with God praying is also who you are out in public with other people, treating them as you want to be treated, living out that law which is love your neighbor as yourself. That's really what Jesus is saying here. And Paul in Romans 13 and Galatians 5 says, again, the whole law comes down to this one commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. You treat others the way you want to be treated.
Well, I've heard this rule taken a step farther. Treat others the way that they want to be treated, as opposed to, you know, just treating someone the way that you want to be treated. Because, you know, and I actually heard a person in a public speech, it wasn't a religious thing, but just said, well, I follow the golden rule. I treat others the way that I want to be treated. And I hate when people tell me happy birthday. But I never wish anybody their happy birthday a happy birthday. Mm-hmm. So if the rest of the, you know, the world wants to be, you know, remembered on their birthday, I mean, that obviously doesn't work.
Right.
So I've actually heard, you know, people take that called platinum rule, and instead of treating others the way that you want to be treated, treat others the way that they want to be treated.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. It's that being respectful to that other person and
right. Well, and of course, what really that raises the question is, you know, when it says do unto others as you want them to do to you, what is that doing that we're talking about? And if it's just the superficial surface things, we do get in those matters of personal preference and so on. You know, I'm the kind of person, you know, if I'm in the hospital, I just prefer people stay at home, don't come bother me, you know. That's how I am, just fine. I won't be offended in the least bit. I won't be pining away in self-pity. Why did anyone come to see me, you know? And neither do I resent people coming and say, how dare you come see me? You know, but you know, that's not going to be, I'm going to turn around and say, well, I don't want people coming to the hospital and bothering me. Well, I'm not going to do that to anyone else. It's really a matter of a deeper level. You know, I want to be treated with respect and love and so on. And so how would I show that to somebody else? And if I know this is how someone perceives that kind of respect and affection and so on, and I will do that for them, even though for me personally it may not be a matter of personal preference for me. And so really it's a matter of getting to that deeper level, I think, and that also avoids even this platinum rule. I've heard the same thing. I mean, yeah, you know, some drunk wants me to buy him, you know, a bunch of whiskey. You know, that's what he wants. I should treat him the way he wants to be treated. Well, but that's not really what's best for him. And on a deeper level, he really wants human dignity and what's right and so on. He doesn't know it. He doesn't know how to find those things. But I have to have the wisdom to know, you know, what the real path to that is. And so he may throw it back in my face, say, well, you're not treating me the way, you know. Well, I really am, you know. So some good points.
Excuse me, we don't always know how other people want to be treated.
Right. Right.
Somebody that you say have a great day, well, don't tell me to have a great day.
Right. And even more, they need to hear that because they're obviously already having a bad one. So, yeah. Well, just quickly, let's summarize the rest of the chapter here. Jesus talks about a narrow way and a wide way. Again, you see those two choices we have. The gate is small. The way is narrow that leads to life. There are few that find it. You know people by their fruits. Good tree can't produce bad fruit. If bad tree can't produce good fruit, verse 18. So you get these series of contrasts again. Which one is true religion? Which one is a false kind of religion? Verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. And again, classically you think of the Pharisees, calling on God as Father, claiming to be God's people, but who really does see God as Lord and will do His will? And the final illustration Jesus gives is the difference between hearing the Word of God and doing it. You know, this old classic, wise man built his house upon the rock and foolish man built his house on the sand, and lots of kids can sing that song, and the main emphasis of the old song is getting to go splat, you know. But what's the spiritual point of that whole story, you know? Well, everyone who hears these words of mine and does them is a wise man who builds his house on a rock. And the one who hears these words of mine and does not do them is the foolish man who builds his house on sand. You know, all people in the world are not described here in this illustration. Just the people that are interested in hearing Jesus, religious people of one kind or another, these great crowds that we saw at the end of chapter 4 that were coming to hear Jesus preach, thousands and thousands of people. They all wanted to hear the words of Jesus, but how many of them wanted to really do them? How many of them really understood how deeply the demands of Jesus cut? You know, just how much you're going to have to give up, how much self-sacrifice is involved, how much self-denial, how much humility, and who really is able to do that and build their house then on the solid foundation of Christ and the foundation that will endure because it's built on God, not on self and self-reliance and self-trust. And so, chapter 7, verse 28, and it came to pass after Jesus had finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. And that marks the end of this wonderful discourse of the Sermon on the Mount. And hopefully it's a good reminder to us of what true discipleship, what the kingdom of God is really about and who can really be in it. Again, this thousands of churches all across America today meeting, millions of people that profess to be Christians and to be interested in Christ. But out of all those millions of people, how many really, when it gets down to it, want to do what Jesus says and will build their life on Him? Well, we'll look at chapter 10 next week. This is the discourse as his disciples are going out on what we commonly refer to as the limited commission. And we'll see how that fits into the overall framework of the Gospel of Matthew, but more particularly, what is the point of that particular discourse and what we can learn from it. So appreciate your comments and your attention this morning. And that's where we will continue with the study next week.